Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, 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 oh. When you come down on earth to enlighten the world with your beautiful flame. Just passing by like a shadow in the night with nothing but a name. One day you'll go, one day.
Going, I think, to a very good place, especially when being accompanied by the great music of Osal by Blessed Brother in Arm, Spirit, and Soul, Rav Yitzhak Patono. I had the unadulterated pleasure of davening with him this morning at the famous Frankel Shul. That's from his Best of Songs for Brother. And we are now live because we want to stay alive in Torat Chaim, Instructions of Life, Torat Chesed, Instructions of Kindness, Torat Rachamim. Welcome, good morning, good afternoon, or maybe even good evening somewhere in the planetary system, the Ein Sof Baruch Hu, the infinite creator. This is Soul Quest number 299, In Search of Ancient Authentic Torah, program number 72. Blessed souls, during our program today, we hope to vibe out on the book of Genesis, chapter 3, verses 18 and 19, quote, and it will cause thorns and thistles to grow for you. And you shall eat the herbs of the field with the sweat of your face or the brow of your brow. You shall eat bread until you return to the ground from where you were taken from. For dust you are, and dust you will return. So are we surprised when the world economic condition, blessed souls, is so shipwrecked for the majority of the human family experience? And that's, we were just referencing the ramifications of the first falling of man and woman, Adam and Chava, and particularly as it was directed to Adam, Adam Arishon. As well, blessed souls, we want to discuss teachings from Rambam, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, teachings from the book of Daniel, Chabad Chassidus, a brief discussion concerning the book of healing, which a king of Israel hid away, which we think will be revealed, or maybe not revealed, speedily in our days, with the universal redemption roaring out to embrace us, unfortunately still too silent within the walls within our hearts. As well, since we're on until hopefully 12 o'clock on Eastern Standard Time, live here on Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA. Meanwhile, we encourage everyone to stay blessed and consider the benefits of meditating towards the common goal of ending suffering upon the Ein Sof Infinite Creator's blessed earth at the center of the Creator's universe. Yes, blessed souls, I am one would like to say, I am not ethnocentric, I am Creator-centric, because for me, in my blessed viewpoint and perspective and limited consciousness, the Creator is central to every molecule, past, present, and future of this blessed universe. Joining me today is longtime co-host, and it's been too long since we did a show, it's almost a month, Dennis Ryan, who is a teacher, a student advocate for the dissemination of the teachings of Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon. My mind is Rambam. Good morning, Dennis.
Boker Tov, Don.
Boker Tov, Dennis. And Dennis, it's almost been a month now, I think, so I hope we are sufficiently all charged up and ready to go, and part of the reasons why for those who have listened to our class on a regular basis, we thank you for your support and your good vibes that I get through Facebook or here through Blog Talk Radio or private emails, that I had two occasions of joy in my family. My daughter, Haimushka, graduated from Kingsburg Community College, which is actually ranked as the fourth best community college in America. That's what we were told by more than one keynote speaker at the graduation. And my dear son, Yosef Yitzhak Goodman, as of, let's see, now 13 days ago, began putting on the phylacteries on his head and his arm to hopefully guide him in a way of channeling the energy that he has been blessed with for the first 12 years and 10-plus months of his life to use it in the service of the Creator as he approaches manhood according to Jewish law. Before we really get things rolling, blessed souls, I want to pull out something from the annals of Chabad Hasidus. And, of course, we'll ask Dennis to give his feedback on this matter, because Dennis' feedback is crucial, and your feedback can be crucial too if you want to get over your telephone shyness, and you can call us in at 347-838-8669. Although we have a certain set amount of material we want to cover today, we don't mind stopping to talk with anyone who wants to call in to vibe in with us, to agree or disagree. And with that being said as well, we just want to mention to everyone that the opinions which are given out by Dennis and I, in my humble opinion, are from the perspective of our own particular understandings of whatever we have accessed in our X amount of years upon this blessed planet Earth. I am not representing any organization, near this Dennis, but we're going to be, during today's show and in future shows, and when the show stops in our normal everyday lives, to be hopefully nourishing and empowering emissaries of the Creator, as every human being is, whether he or she is aware of it or whether he or she like it or not. So I'm going to be plucking right now generously from a Hasidic discourse that was put together by spoken out by the 6th Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzhak Schneerson, when he was doing a 10-month tour of America back in 1929. So let's go back to 1929, blessed soul. That was, I don't remember exactly what part of the year 1929 the Great Depression broke out, but at that time this Hasidic Rebbe, direct descendant of King David and Solomon, wanted to spread the news among the Jewish people at the time because he spoke primarily Yiddish. To my knowledge, he did not learn English. But now that these teachings have been translated into Hebrew and English, we can share some nuggets to hopefully give some renewed spirit and hope and vim and vigor spiritually and intellectually and cognitively to anyone who needs it in this time, as we're still going through some rough times economically, certainly spiritually, certainly cognitively, and of course as well mentally. So it goes like this. I'm basically recapitulating this teaching from the 6th Lubavitcher Rebbe. Who renews each day? Is this renewal continual? And if we attribute the renewal of each day to the Creator, which attributes is each day, from which attribute is each day, which seems to be the concept of day, D-A-Y, which seems to be a seemingly puny vessel, can be expressed as in the time frame of 24 hours, or 1,440 minutes, or 74,440 consecutive seconds. So what type of attributes are involved from the Creator which interfaces time with all the worlds of action, speech, and thought? and even one-tenth of the world of intellect that the Creator nurtures each day, this puny vessel which will interface with the rest of creation. Well, it's called Hateva Hatov Lehetiv. It is the nature of the good or the benevolent to do good. So here we have, blessed souls, a world or worlds as described above, four general portrayals according to the inner dimensions of Torah, Panimis HaTorah. Bearing that in mind, since at one level or another, we as conscious human beings deal mostly with this world of action because we are physical beings, working with, struggling with many tough moments. Sometimes those moments are not tough. Sometimes they seem to be seemingly too easy, or sometimes they're in between easy and too tough. Yet with that being said, we should hopefully be not just faithful, but in good spirit, that with each day in which, for instance, we complete a cycle of 74,400 consecutive seconds, we live in the Creator's concept of day for us to try to access with our puny human minds. And with that opportunity, we can appreciate the entirety of all the creation, which really, if you think about it from a volume perspective, how can you fit the expanse of the creation? Now with modern science, with all these telescopes and radar systems and sound systems that beam out particles of light and sound, it's almost as measurable as the infinite universe may seem to be. It's really ultimately impossible to measure the total expense. Scientists have to calculate. Yet we can appreciate it within those 74,400 consecutive seconds. So I'm going to turn the ball over to Dennis about appreciating this puny day, Dennis, and yet we can think about the entirety of the creation according to our limited consciousness.
Well, time is a dimension that we really don't understand. We cannot control it. We cannot speed it up, and we can't slow it down. Yet, we can have people arguing about, from a scientific viewpoint, what is the exactitude of a definition of a day. But think of this. How long would it take any human being to shout out in their head, God, I love you? That is seconds. The renewal can be done in seconds. You don't have to wait 24 hours. 24 hours is a human measurement. Mm-hmm. Our minds are set for a limitless time in our head. Our head doesn't go to sleep when our body does. It continues on doing what it normally does, entertaining ideas. Some people call it dreams. Some people call it nightmares. Our mind keeps on going. So if at any time, regardless of what time of the year it is it a hot day or a cold day, you can give thanks to God in seconds. So the renewal is up to you.
Amen. Thank you, Dennis. Now, Dennis, before we turn to the Rambam, I felt this story that I read yesterday on Sabbath in the famous Frankel Shul here in Kesser Crown Heights. It was something that I think that a lot of people will find interesting. And it's the combination of basically faith and learning. Now, with that being said, I'm gonna just drop the phone for 10 seconds just to pull out the Talmudic tractate of Brachas. Just hold on 1 second, please. We pulled it out because we didn't do a proper preparation, but that's okay. So what we're going to do, Dennis, is we're going to, and blessed listeners out there, we're going to read a story that was, there's basically a series called My Encounter with the Rebbe. And it's an oral history project dedicated to documenting the life of the Lubavitcher Rebbe of righteous memory. And one of the people who wanted to record for posterity his interaction with the Rebbe basically focuses on how this young man dealt with his personal suffering and how his personal suffering was alleviated through the learning of Torah. Now, Torah, as well as being an instruction, has many side benefits. The main thing is that it's telling us what is the Word of God. And as we of Israel will humbly point out to the rest of the creation, that includes all the written and the oral traditions, and what sometimes can confuse people is that the oral tradition seems to have a lot of argumentation, but rather it's to allow the person observing the argumentation or the disagreement that takes place in that particular discussion in order that, number one, to realize that some discussions are not, are in terms of finding the proper response or the ultimate solution, are not possible. Some were discovered later in time, historically speaking, and some were solved on the spot. So here's a situation, here's a scenario we're going to share with everyone right now about a young man and the education he got with a faith-based approach within authentic Torah Judaic studies, and how interfacing with the Rebbe gave him the strength to get to a very particular hard period in his life. So here we go. Before World War II, this is the transcript of an interview with Mr. Yaakov Schiffman, who lives in Flatbush section of Brooklyn, and he did an interview with my encounters, the team over there, which is connected to Jewish Educational Media, which has a ton of videos you can see for free online. So Mr. Schiffman reports the following story to us, and I'm going to share with everyone. Before World War II, my father learned in a yeshiva in Hungary. Although he was not from a Hasidic background, he made sure that I got some exposure to Hasidic perspectives. When I was a child, he took me to see the Lubavitcher Rebbe and also to the Satmar Rebbe and the Babov Rebbe. He wanted me to experience the whole spectrum of Judaic teachings, the modern side, the Hasidic side, the non-Hasidic side, to see what it's all about. That way, wherever I found myself, I'd be able to fit in. Certainly, his father was quite open-minded. Now, in 1973, Mr. Schiffman continued, my bar mitzvah year, my parents sent me to a summer camp in Israel. When I came back, I learned that my father was about to undergo surgery. It turned out that he had cancer of the colon cancer. May we never know of this dreadful disease. And from that point on, his health went downhill. Now, 2 years later, just before Purim, which is a Jewish holiday, of course, my father's condition took a turn for the worse. We went to the hospital, and the doctors examined him when they called me in and said, quote, you better go home. Your father is staying here tonight. That night, they opened him up, but they saw there wasn't much they could do just to make the end as painless as possible. Of course, we didn't want to give up, so we went to several rabbis for blessings. We even tried the alternative medicines at the time, but my father was losing a lot of weight. He was 5'6", but pretty soon he only weighed about 90 pounds. Nothing was working. Then one cousin told us, quote, you should go see the Lubavitcher Rebbe. It was winter, the first week of the month of Kislev, which is the month of Hanukkah. Five of us went, my father, my mother, my grandmother, my sister, and I. My father was so ill. He was haggard. His face had lost its luster. We entered the Rebbe's room. I stood in the back of the room, and my father spoke quietly with the Rebbe for a few minutes. When the Rebbe finished speaking with my father, we began to leave, but suddenly the Rebbe said to me, you stay. I was already anxious with everything that was going on with my father's deteriorating situation. I was only 16 years old at the time, and I got very, very nervous. So the Rebbe said to me, come over, gesturing that I should approach. He went over to a shelf and pulled out two Talmudic tractates of brachas, meaning two books, and he said to me in Yiddish, by the laws of medicine, your father is extremely sick now. He's near the end. God will help, but your father will be depressed, and you're going to be depressed. You need something to give you strength. I want to teach you something which will help keep you going. He opened to page 10a in the Talmudic tractate and began to teach me the story from the Book of Kings, number 2, which everyone, I openly encourage you to look at after the show, even during the show. Book of Kings, number 2, chapter 20, verses 1 through 6, where the Talmud talks about the intense discussion that took place between Isaiah the prophet and his relative, Chizkiyahu HaMelech, King Hezekiah. And at that point, Hezekiah was actually dying, and the prophet told the king that his days were numbered and he should prepare to die. But Hezekiah, or Chizkiyahu HaMelech, refused to accept this, and he said, no, I have faith in God. Although the prophet said it was too late, Hezekiah began to pray because, quote, from the Talmudic tractate of the oral tradition that Hezekiah told to Isaiah, the prophet, because he was from the house of David and Solomon, it was a tradition in the house of David and Solomon that even if the tip of the sword is pointed at your throat, you should never give up hope. So Mr. Schiffman continued to reflect, I was standing across the desk from the Rebbe, and he was sitting. But in the middle of the story, the Rebbe motioned for me to come around the desk, and I looked into the volume together with him. He translated the dialogue slowly into Yiddish, word by word, pointing to the place like a father teaches his son. The point the Talmud is making through the story is that we should not mix into God's business. We have to do what we have to do, and God does what he has to do. I remember him pointing to the words with his finger, then looking at me and pointing again. He had me repeat it until it was clear that I understood, and although my father was quite knowledgeable in Talmud, the Rebbe wanted to make sure that I understood the idea of this Talmudic piece, and I explained it to my father as well, that even at death's doorstep, you should never give up hope, you should never become depressed, and you should accept God's will. It took some time. It took us about 25 minutes to learn that piece of Talmud. What stood out in my mind more than anything else is the earnest, loving way the Rebbe looked at me. I never saw that type of love. I was a stranger to him, as far as I understood, a young boy coming with his father who needed a blessing. He gave his blessing, and then he gave much more. He saw that this boy needed fatherly love, and he gave it. When I came out of the Rebbe's office, I was sweating. As we drove home, I told my father what had happened, and he broke down and cried. As soon as we got home, we learned that piece at least 3 or 4 times. I remember my father asked me a few times, do you understand why the Rebbe told you to learn this with me? Do you understand? Well, unfortunately, 2.5 months later, Mr. Schiffman's father passed away, and Yaakov mentioned that he was on the verge of becoming despondent because he didn't have any relatives to look after him, and his mother was an only child, and my father's whole family had been wiped out at the war, and I was only 16 years old, so we're talking around 1976. But with all that being said, Mr. Schiffman concluded, I don't know how to thank the Rebbe for this fact, but he sat down with me and told me the facts of life. Everyone else had been telling me, quote, no, it'll be good, it'll be good. The Rebbe looked at me and told me how to be prepared for it, which was the bitter end with his father's passing on. I had times when things got tough. I left yeshiva for a while and wandered away, but then I remembered what the Rebbe taught me. Through those years, I probably learned that piece of Talmud 30 times, and it got me back on track. The fact that I'm a Jew of observant Orthodox Torah Jewry, and then I raised a beautiful family so far, Kanahara, is because of the day when the Rebbe spent so much time with me and explained it to me. When you have a problem and you're feeling you've hit rock bottom, remember, never give up because God is there. Open your heart to him, and he will help you. Dennis, now I'm sure you'll have what to say, the fusion of faith and learning, learning in faith, and how that seminal experience in that young man's life at the age of 16 helped him start a process of recovery after his father passing about 2.5 months after that meeting with the Rebbe. What do you take from that, and what can we learn from it?
Well, we have some obvious observations here, Don, and that is it can happen at any age. There's mm-hmm. no set form for that. There's no set detail in terms of time. However, we do know that there's people older than us and there's people younger than us. And we do know the older people are not going to be around. They die. So we have a thing called life and death, and then we have ashes to ashes, dust to dust. So people have to understand you are here on a temporary basis. And the total value of your being here resides in the ashes to ashes and dust to dust on a human basis. We're here, really, to serve God, mm-hmm. which is not on a human basis. That is on a spiritual basis. So what happens is that faith and belief will carry us forward. However, we have to be mindful that God has an overall plan. What it is, we don't know. To even try to understand it, you're wasting your time. Because there's some people that stay here, some people that go to heaven, some people go to hell. Now, I don't know the other places they could go to because I've never met anybody from them. So therefore, it has never been written down as to what happens when you pass from this life. But what we do know, and this is know, comes from the word knowledge, or knowledge comes from the word know. And that mm-hmm. is that we must learn. You must know, because when you're born, you don't know anything. You're just mm-hmm. trying to grab for sustenance. Mm-hmm. And when you die, you're regretful of all the things you could have done, but you didn't. However, if you have faith and belief, that will overcome any other shortcomings that you have. Why? Because the Lord is willing to accept you under any circumstances as long as you can be faithful to Him. Now, to be faithful to Him means that you have to know something about Him. If you don't know anything about Him, well, then you can live in your own world, die in your own world. But it's better to die in God's world.
True. Dennis, you know, no stranger to suffering and faith and knowledge was Rambam, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon. So maybe you'd like to share with us, let's segue to that now. What would you like to share with us today, sir, concerning the wisdom? Despite the fact he suffered greatly, he lost his first wife at an early age, he lost his brother at a young age who was his sole support, he lived to see the massacres that took place in where he grew up in Spain. Please remind me the city that he grew up in again, sir. In the city of Rambam's beginnings. Dennis? Not Toledo. Where did he start? I forgot.
I just lost the tooth, and I'm concentrating on other things.
Okay, but Rambam, basically, he witnessed the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. He lost a wife at an early age. He lost a brother in early age who was his support, and then Rambam had to find his own means of support. He also had to deal with a...
Cordoba.
I'm sorry? Cordoba?
Cordoba.
Cordoba, right. With or without the fine Corinthian leather? Remember, who was that Ricardo Montalban talked about the Cordoba, the fine Corinthian leather. Okay, Don just had a flashback from the 1970s. For those of you who are old enough to remember Ricardo Montalban. Anyway, he was a great actor. So, Dennis, what would you like to share with us today from the great teacher? And he endured a lot of suffering in his life and seemed to come out quite okay, I think, Rambam.
All right. Well, we have the Guide for the Perplexed. Now, this was written in Arabic originally, and it's been translated over and over. I just wanted to mention that because you mentioned an older letter that you read earlier, Don, that wasn't in English. So it isn't the language that stops the knowledge of God. It can be translated into any language. So that's why we're going to be reading from the Guide for the Perplexed. And in a heading on page 261, we have, Man Can Control His Passions, at the top of the page. However, I'm going to be reading from chapter 8 in there. Now, we have to remember that there's three, in this particular chapter, there's three words that we use in English that don't mean so much when we use it in common communication. However, if you use it on an intellectual level, which is higher than common usage, they have a deeper meaning. So I just wanted to let everybody know the three words are form, substance, and matter. We all think they're simple English words, but they have a meaning to them that has a spiritual background. So let me read, so you don't need to listen to me. Anyway, chapter 8, and here we go. Transient bodies are only subject to the destruction through their substance and not through their form. Nor can the essence of their forms be destroyed. It is in this respect they are permanent. The generic forms, as you know, are all permanent and stable. Form can only be destroyed accidentally, i.e., on account of its connection with substance, the true nature of which exists in the property of never being without a disposition to receive form. This is the reason why no form remains permanently in a substance. A constant change takes place. One form is taken off and another is put on. How wonderfully wise is the simile of King Solomon, in which he compares matter to a faithless wife. For matter is never found without form, and is therefore always like such a wife who is never without a husband, never single, and yet though being wedded, constantly seeks another man in the place of her husband. She entices and attracts him in every possible manner, till he obtains from her what her husband has obtained. The same is the case with matter. Whatever form it has, it is disposed to receive another form. It never leaves off moving and casting from the form which it has in order to receive another. The same takes place when the second form is received. It is therefore clear that all corruption, destruction, and defect comes from matter. Take, for example, man. His deformities and unnatural shape of limbs, all weaknesses, interruptions, or disorder in his actions, whether innate or not, originate in the transient substance, not in the form. All other living beings likewise die or become ill through the substance of the body and not its form. Man's shortcomings and sins are due to the substance of the body and not to its form, while all his merits are exclusively due to his form. Thus, the knowledge of God, the information of ideas, the mastery of desire and passion, the distinction between that which is chosen and that which is to be rejected, all these man owes to his form. But eating, drinking, sexual intercourse, excessive lust, passion, and all vices have their origin in the substance of the body. Now it was dear that it was the case. It was possible, according to the wisdom of God, that substance should exist without form, or any of the forms of the bodies without substance, and it was necessary that the very noble form of man, which is the image and likeness of God, as has been shown by us, should be joined to the substance of dust and darkness, the source of all defect and loss. For these reasons, the Creator gave to the form of man power, rule, and domination over the substance. The form can subdue the substance, refuse the fulfillment of its desires, and reduce them, as far as possible, to a just and proper measure. The station of man varies according to the exercise of his power.
Dennis, that is so powerful. The things that are ringing through my mind is that, you know, there is a Hasidic teaching that talks about the concept of man. And, of course, this is also referring to woman because, you know, we have in our tradition that the completeness of a human being is when he takes a wife and she accepts upon herself to be married to a man. And the Hasidic teaching indicates that in the form, in the design, as you've indicated or read from Rambam's kind of Perplexed, also known as Tzorah in Hebrew, there is perfection. However, in the substance, in the actual physicality life of a human being, there is imperfection. And it's not necessarily because we are imperfect, but the fact that we are grasped in a physical body, I want to be very clear about this, which then must interact with other forms of physicality. For instance, Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden had to interact with the produce of their time, which is basically the herbs and grasses and fruits. And unfortunately, they fell to the physicality and the guiles of that primordial snake, which caused them to blemish their physicality. Now, we would humbly suggest that in their soul essence, they were not touched. But that level from soul essence beaming all the way down to what we call as light, to the level of the foot of their soul, meaning not all of the soul is invested in the body, or not all of the form is invested into the body because of the body's lackings, is that that's where the trouble can happen, and that's why we are given a chance to fix things up in this world. We're basically caretakers of ourselves, hopefully in the most independent fashion as possible, because when we're as independent as possible, spiritually, economically, emotionally, we can recognize how, if we are independent, how much greater so is the Creator, independent of being held back by anything that the Creator has created. So that teaching of Rambam is a for me personally, it is a teaching to remind myself personally, and hopefully I suggest anyone who heard that teaching will hear the archive version, hopefully in the near future. It's a teaching to humble us that, you know, our form remains intact, our soul essence remains intact, but we were put here on a mission, and if we are under the perspective that I was created to serve my Creator, then we can deal with our imperfections, we can deal with our quirks, we can deal with our sometimes abnormal reactions, where, as opposed to what would be expected from us from a higher consciousness, from the angelic realm, all the way back up to the Creator. But there is kindness on the part of the Creator, which we talked about at the beginning of the show, that because He is the source of all good, He's merciful to all of us, that we're allowed to stumble in this world, despite our physicality, but that hopefully we can get supercharged or elevated or empowered by remembering we have a form, or a tzorah, which in and of itself is a complete work which the Creator designed from within His realms, which we cannot understand, the Creator unto Himself. And therefore, we can take a teaching like this and reevaluate, well, how do I make this symbiotic, synergistic relationship between my physicality and the form that the Creator has deemed to be in the human form for myself to live this life on this earth, hopefully in a pleasant and peaceful manner. Dennis, any feedback on what I just said? Or anything else you want to elaborate from the Rambam?
Well, he said a lot, Don, but let's put it this way. When we're born, we are innocent and pure. This part of Maimonides coming out and saying this is like a warning that during your entire life, you're going to be challenged by change. The question is, can you control the change so that you come out on top? And that is the fight that we renew every day when we're born, like we started the program from the Lubavitcher Rebbe saying a 24-hour period. Here's Rambam saying this from umpteen centuries ago. Change is there. Can you handle it? Are you equipped to handle it? Do you have enough knowledge to handle it? Because if you don't, you're going to feel like you wasted a lot of time somewhere. And time cannot be taken back. Every minute that you give up for no reason is a lost minute. Now, that doesn't mean everybody should be busy like a bee, but you should have an object and a path that you're following.
True. Dennis, beautiful. I'd like, Dennis, now, if you don't mind, I'd like to move on to the teachings of Maimonides, a book we read from in the past, giving a sort of historical perspective of Rambam and his challenges in dispersing his knowledge that he himself had gained through years and years of toiling in the teachings of Torah and toiling in the areas of science and mathematics and different types of philosophies and not seeing it a contradiction to few, put it together in one commentary. To disperse out into the creation. And this is, again, by Jacob S. Minkin. It's published by Aronson. It goes like this, that the Rambam had wrote a commentary to the Mishnah and is considered to be one of the great achievements of rabbinic learning. Yet, ironically, it did not meet with immediate universal recognition at the hands of his fellow Jewish scholars. Some rabbis remained indifferent to the work of the young Spanish scholar with motives of jealousy. Some challenged the fundamental character of Maimonides, which we've talked about in programs going way back. If you go back into the archives of Salt Talk, In Search of Ancient Authentic Torah, his 13 articles of faith. Others resented the introduction of what they called irrelevant, controversial scientific material into purely Talmudic subjects, while others took exception to the writer's frequent departure from the Talmudic interpretation of the Mishnah in favor of his own exposition. There was but the faintest understanding of Maimonides' great historic work in his own country, which was Spain, and also as well in Egypt, and the Franco-German scholars, talking about the rabbinical scholars, never were much into the philosophical involvements. And with that being said, they also had a commentator of great reverence, who we've talked about many times, the revered Rashi, who lived in the Common Era from 1040 to 1105, and were no need of any other scholar to give them the unique outlook that Rambam had. Now, what's also interesting is that the language which the commentary was written may have had something to do with its slow progress among Talmudic scholars. Because I believe, we'll read further. Students of the Torah were accustomed to seeing Jewish scholarship written in the national language of the Jews. Not to say the Goanim, but the schools of Talmudic learning which followed them had, with rare exceptions, composed their works in any other but the Hebrew language, like, say, in Aramaic. Albeit a far cry from the language of the Bible, Rashi wrote even beautiful poetic Hebrew, which was the case of a good many other commentators of the Bible and the Talmud. Another example of that is Ramban, who would follow in the footsteps of Rambam. So Arabic was actually, to the Jews, the language of the descendants of Yishmael, who enjoy a rather unavailable reputation in, an inviolable reputation in rabbinic literature. And I just want to mention as a very poignant footnote, a great scholar by the name of Ibn Ezra mentioned that actually in the category of Lashon HaKodesh, the Holy Tongue, he considers it's actually a mixture of three languages, which might ruffle the feathers of some. The Holy Tongue is composed, according to Ibn Ezra, who was a giant scholar in his days, more than 700 years ago, to be a mixture of Hebrew, Aramaic, and Arabic. Very interesting. When someone asks you in the future, what is the Holy Tongue, you can say, oh, it's Hebrew, Arabic, and Aramaic. Well, you might rather ruffle their feathers, but you can say the name of Ibn Ezra. He told us that we could ruffle your feathers. Okay, let's go further more into the book. Although the commentary was translated into Hebrew, the style is heavy and often difficult to follow, meaning when it was translated from the Arabic into the Hebrew. It was, however, not very long before the commentary received the recognition that was due it. It appeared in most editions of the Talmud. It met with the accolades of scholars, and its lengthy excursions were widely hailed as having laid the foundation for Talmudic scholarship on historic scientific lines. Many scholars have been unstinting in their praise and admiration for his unprecedented, stupendous work. Quote, it is that the commentary was the first scientific treatment of the Talmud, and only so clearly and systematic a thinker as Maimonides could have originated, says the historian Graetz, G-R-A-E-T-Z. Quote, he blazed a path not trodden by any other man before, quote, and end of quote, writes Zachariah Frankel, and so high a Noahide or non-Jewish authority as Hermann Strack pronounced a commentary as an indispensable guide to the study of the Mishnah. Now, Rambam's genius is equaled only by his character. The man who delved into the deepest metaphysical problems of the universe was not a secluded scholar who lived in isolation from the world. He was profoundly concerned with the troubles and the vicissitudes of the world, especially as they affected the fortunes of his troubled people. Intellectual aristocrat though he was never more completely at home than when in the midst of the humblest of his co-religionists. Whereas the scholars admired him for his great learning, the great masses of Jews knew him as their unfailing guide and wise counselor. His life had no higher devotion than the touching dedication to his sorrow-stricken, suffering brothers and sisters. He knew from his own experience, and it's kind of written he knew from his own experience as the luxury of being a Jew in a strange and hostile environment, meaning when he lived in Cordoba, Spain at the time of the expulsion of the Jews, and when he lived in Egypt when he was the doctor to the Sultan of Egypt and had to constantly deal with the machinations of the other court, the people who were in the court of the king, who at times actually tried to do things to undermine his sovereignty as the doctor of the Sultan. So we'll leave it at that. Dennis, any commentaries on people finally got in his days, or a little after his demise, I believe at the beginning of the 13th century, that Rambam was on the ball, it's just that they were just not up to his level of consciousness yet.
Well, now you're getting in my wheelhouse, Don. I read the commentary on the Mishnah. I never had read the Mishnah, but after reading the commentary, I understood the Mishnah. I also understood all the objections to the people that were what they were making at the time, because he was offering a fresh and renewed viewpoint of ancient history. He was actually taking the old ideas and upgrading them to change without losing the content or the meaning intended. So what he was doing was he was re-emphasizing what is important for knowledge. And therefore, he was showing a way for future change. Not many people can do that. Now, a lot of people at the time knew he had a pretty good intellect, but they were expecting, like the other people, to be arrogant with his thoughts. He was humble. He did not say, this is my way of doing anything. He just kept saying, this is a better way to honor God. Now, with those motives, it's very hard, and it was very hard for me to understand how knowledgeable, honest Jewish people and non-Jewish people could get mad at him. Why? Because he was basically pointing out some things they had missed. And by doing that, he set the table to open up discussion. And to me, intellectual discussion is very precious. We don't find it everywhere, and not everybody is capable of doing it. But this man stood out among other men.
Beautiful, Dennis. You know, I remember learning something way back from a great teacher and great scholar, and actually a very humane human being. His name was Reb Hillel of Porich. He lived from 1795 to, I think, about 1860. And he talked about two different types of teachers. Teacher number one, when he or she teaches you, the way they present it is if they're giving you the entire ocean of knowledge. And that can be overwhelming for people. It also sets up that teacher to be in a certain spot where they can, if their evil inclination is activated, not every teacher is like this, but those who give the presentation, they're giving you the whole picture, that they can put themselves on a pedestal, and how dare you question their ideas or bring in even an insight or even correct them on perhaps a mistake they made, because we all make mistakes. Teacher number two is that when he or she teaches, they present it in a way that what you are receiving is merely a drop in the ocean. But no one just wants to get a drop in the ocean. They want to encourage you, plunge into the ocean yourself. Yes, there'll be undertows, and there'll be some high waves, there'll be low tides, high tides, and be careful of those crabs at the bottom of the sea, and, you know, forget about the jellyfish. Who wants to get stung by a jellyfish? And, you know, when you get past the jetty, say, like a Coney Island, you know, our friend Mr. Shark is hanging out there. But at least the teacher had the intention that when he shares, or he or she shares that information with you, it's to lead you along the path of truth and growth. And I think Rambam was of the second category, Dennis, in my humble opinion. What's your take on that?
I don't think you can put him in either category, because what he did was he opened things up without tearing anything down.
That's right.
The only thing of evidence, of evidentiary nature, that they could point the finger at him is that he left out a whole bunch of anecdotal scripture. And they were saying, why? How could you do that? Who appointed you to judge to do that? What he was doing was keeping to the grindstone and not diverting and creating all sorts of branches everywhere and here and there. He's saying, if this comes from a tree, we got the root, here's the trunk of the tree, let's make sure all the branches are going to be satisfied without knowing how many branches are going to be there. But he said, I don't want to follow everything that was preconceived in every such way, because humans, as we know, are imperfect. So there were imperfect people along the way. That doesn't mean their motives were bad. That doesn't mean they were evil or anything like that. But if he left out some anecdotes, I think he was making a judgment that this would not help you in understanding what he was trying to teach. So therefore, I got to say, this man was a genius to a certain extent, that he could talk to the man in the street and an advanced scholar in some university, because he could reduce things to their basics and show you that everything is touched by God.
Right. Dennis, someone just knocked on my door. Maybe you can continue to elaborate. I'm going to go answer the front door. This is live radio, and like we mentioned, who knows what can happen to a live radio. Just speak for a minute or two, and I'm going to see who's at the door. Hold on, please.
Well, if you want to hear me for a minute or two, I can put you to sleep, too, but that's not why you're listening into this program here. Let me continue on with
Hello?
Hello.
Okay, okay, so we're back. So, Dennis, we're, and blessed souls at that, we're going to segue to our musical portion of the show. And while the show started, I happened to see a very interesting post by good brother in arms and soul spirit and positive thoughts. His Facebook name is Beatnik, but we all know him as Joshua Sirk. I haven't given any state secrets. He has a channel on YouTube. He's a wonderful musician. And he quoted the following. And he quoted, I don't know if this is a music theorist or a musician or a philosopher. He quoted the following from John Frusciante, Frusciante. Have you heard of him, Dennis? I never heard of him.
Never heard of him, Don.
Okay, so before we play the song, that Beatnik or / Joshua Sirk quoted the following from John Frusciante. Again, I hope I'm to Mr. Frusciante that I'm pronouncing your name correctly. He wrote the following, and Josh printed it out on his commentary on his wall on Facebook. Music is energy. And the energy is the most single most important form of it in the world. Without energy, there is no life. The only difference between a dead person and a live person is the energy, the electricity flowing inside their system. And that's what makes music. And I have some beautiful music now, blessed souls, that I'm very happy to share with you. It's by a group called Eighth Day, who have been around for a little bit, but they're, you know, every once in a while they're being heard more and more, and their music is cutting edge because it's not just, as we say in Yiddish, it's not the same old shtick and just recapitulating songs, which are certainly wonderful when you quote the Book of Psalms or different books from the written scripture or even oral Torah tradition. This song is a pensive, self-reflecting song. It's called Avraham, which is the Hebrew name for Abraham, the first patriarch of Israel. As it's known, that Avraham's name means not just one who, as the name is Avram, his name meant one of exalted wisdom, but Avraham also implied that he was also called Am Hamon Goyim, that he is the father of many nations, not necessarily biologically, but the influence of Avraham cannot in any way be extracted from Judaic, Christian, or Islamic faith. I mean, basically you have these three faiths which were catapulted into the creation, the Most High's creation, by that seminal figure of Avraham. So this song, Eighth Day, which takes about 4 minutes and 52 seconds, which I'm very pleased and honored to play for you now, blessed souls, asks the question, are we the seed of Avraham that Avraham dreamed about thousands of years ago, which is talked about in the biblical prophecy? So without further ado, this is Eighth Day in Avraham. I think it's a beautiful song, and let's take it away. Enjoy, everyone. Take us home. And that was Abraham by this young and upcoming, I think, probably one of the more influential Jewish bands within the Jewish community and in the greater Noah community for years to come, with Hashem's blessings. That was Abraham, and personally I like that music because that song challenges us, I believe, through the lyrics to ask ourselves, are we a continuation of the faith of Abraham? And I speak in the universal sense, whether we be Jew, whether we be Christian or Muslim. And by the way, there are influences of the Abrahamic consciousness which actually seeped into other belief systems, but that hopefully will be for another show. Dennis, the responsibility of adhering or clinging to a faith, whether it be Jewish, Christian, or Islam or Muslim, Islamic, it can't go off the path of Abraham. It was a life of loving the human family experience. It was a one of empowering human beings. In fact, I heard from more than one rabbi, we shouldn't be surprised if the way of the Messiah, the Mashiach, it should seem exactly like that of Abraham, but it will be at a more elevated level since he will be the one to lead the human family experience into universal redemption. Your thoughts on those matters?
Since we're imperfect, we don't know everything, and we're in a world of change, yes, we can get off the beaten path, but we always come back. Now, you can only do that with one word, and that is hope. Some people commit suicide from time to time. That's what happens when you have no hope. You have no meaning to wake up tomorrow, because you know it's not worth it, because you've reached the end today. That's not true. With your faith and your belief, we continue on. That's called trust in a spiritual area. If you don't have that, you just become a shell of a human, a human has the possibility to cross that bridge into the spiritual world of God. It may take time, as in life and death, but you must start somewhere. You must have a connection somewhere. You can only believe in yourself for so long. And after a while, self becomes boring. Boring because you don't have help, you don't have hope in self, and you know you're not going to change, or the change may not be better. So we hope that every day we wake up is going to be better than the last. But that included in that hope is that we will be able to do better. By doing better means we stay on the path to righteousness and the Lord.
Beautiful. Dennis and Blessed Souls out there, we'd like to move on to a brief discussion before we wind up our show. From chapter 1, verse 5 in the book of Daniel, and that will hopefully segue into the book of Remedies, Sefer Refuos, that we mentioned at the beginning of the show. Will it be revealed or won't it be revealed at the time of the universal redemption? So let's first read the verse. Chapter 1, verse 5 in the book of Daniel. And is referring to Nebuchadnezzar, who was then the king of Babylon. And the king provided for them a daily portion from the king's food and from his drinking wine to nurture them for 3 years, after which they should stand before the king. Now, the significance of the 3 years, according to Alshich, who was a rabbinical commentator, was number one, that they should become knowledgeable of the native tongue, or the script of the Chaldeans, the Kazdim, and that as well, the Alshik further elucidated, that Nebuchadnezzar, King Nebuchadnezzar, supplied the youths with three things which are conducive to the attainment of excellence of studies. Number one, peace of mind. A person cannot take in knowledge without some sense of peace of mind, and that's where the faith and trust kick in. Number two, proper food. And last but not least, an extended period of time for study. Now, in order that the youth would have peace of mind, the king provided for them, thus freeing them from the burden of seeking their own sustenance. To ensure that the youth would have proper food, that the king would actually send provisions from food he himself, that he felt was most suitable, and the best food available for strengthening both the body and mind, would be to allow sufficient time for the accumulation of knowledge. And the king supported these youths for 3 years in this manner. Now, as well as a parenthetical statement that the sages of Israel mentioned, but again, this is an advanced level of study. Let's say like at a postgraduate level, we're not going to say for a grade school level, God forbid, whereas basically this three-year period is that if a person does not succeed in 3 years of, let's say, elevated, accelerated type of study, it's going to be more likely than not that they're not going to be able to become successful in those types of studies, and that they should become, let me just turn to the next page here, and that that's basically it, that they basically should be fed a proper diet, they should have rest, and they should be able to learn the language with a sense of peace of mind. Now, you know, Dennis and I are working adults, and we all know, as being workers and family members, husbands and fathers, and hopefully in the proper time, grandfathers. I forgot, Dennis, if you're a grandfather or not, you'll remind me after I stop speaking in a moment or two, that there have to be situations where conducive for the accumulation of new knowledge. And that's why one of the reasons why we like to do this type of show on a Sunday is that hopefully most of the people listening in or will be listening in the archive are doing it on a day off or at a time they finish their work schedule. This type of show, I think, is best, most accessible when we're talking about subject matters which are completely new to most people listening in, or they've started to tune in for the last couple of years, but they want to be able to take it in a little bit deeper. Dennis, so Nebuchadnezzar's approach wasn't evil. It was just, it just shows that even back in ancient times, nothing really changed. In order to facilitate proper learning at that accelerated level, they had to learn a new language, and they learned the sciences of those times, the philosophies of the Chaldeans, the Chazdim. there had to be certain things put in motion. So we're not surprised that these conditions were set up to ensure the success of the youth who were taken from the tribe of Judah, in order that eventually it was Nebuchadnezzar's desire that they should stand before him as his ministers. Any take on these matters?
Yeah, it's called human nature, Don. if you want people to change their mind and think good of you, you fatten them up. You treat them like guests, give them a lot of food, lots of rest. Wow. Now, if you want to tell them anything, they'd be open-minded to it, because they don't want that food to go away, and they don't want the rest. Because human nature also extended to Russia in the communist areas, not areas, but Russia itself, because most of those people were not getting fed on a regular day. They had to scrounge to get sustenance. When you're, communism sounds good when you're very, very hungry.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened after all those people now are starting to eat and they're getting regular meals and they're feeling comfortable? Communism doesn't seem that important. But that's human nature. Things come and go. And it's not an evil trick, but I think you were being very, or maybe you were reading from the book, it was being very diplomatically, because there's a certain amount of intelligence of how to control or point people in the right direction. Nothing wrong with that. By the way, Maimonides also read a lot of Chaldean type of ideas, concepts, and other stuff, and he incorporated that in his general thinking. It just hit me when you said the word, because I know he was very interested in their way of thinking, and he didn't want to exclude them.
True. And also, too, I mean, I think, Dennis, again, that was a type of accelerated learning for those youths, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, and also for Daniel. But we see, too, it's like in the, I mean, I'm just speaking because I went through it, the American educational system, basically, aside from, basically, there's kindergarten and grades 1 through 12, basically, a human being growing up here in the West, in the United States, has an opportunity to go basically 13 years at the beginning of their life cycle, basically from age 5 to 18, to not have to work. And hopefully, I myself as a teenager started taking part-time jobs here and there from the age of 16 onward and work in the summer. But generally speaking, that, you know, I was fortunate enough to have been raised by my parents who did not require me to work. But they were not against it when I decided that I wanted to put a little chain, you know, some coins in my pocket. So it's an idea which is not just for elevated learning. The idea of having, you know, the proper peace of mind. And unfortunately, again, in these beleaguered days where there's so much concern, whether it be, I don't know, as a topic matter, environmental problems and the terrorists, and, you know, what's going to be in the Middle East, what's going to be with the water, what's going to be with the gas, if a high school student doesn't, you know, keep their nose in the book, I'm not saying they shouldn't be aware of what's going on in the world. For those of us who are dealing with the day-to-day mundanities of the work world, plus all the worries that are broadcast over the media, unfortunately, we get more worryful information than positive, empowering information, which, again, this humble effort here on is sort of like a response to the negativities over the airwaves and the television and the movies, is that, you know, a person can lose track. And with that being said, I also want to bring out now this little parenthetical point from the Book of Remedies, Sefer Fuos, that Hezekiah, who we learned about earlier in today's show, which, again, you can learn more about from the second Book of Kings, chapter 1, verses 1 through 6. He's also mentioned in other places in the Tanakh and in the parts after the five books of Moses, the Book of Kings. I think he's also, he's mentioned in the Book of Isaiah, that there was actually a book called the Book of Remedies, which contained in it the natural healing properties of all various herbs and grasses in existence up until the time of Chizkiah, who lived about 2,600 years ago. And those who were ill relied upon these natural remedies and refrained, this is the interesting point, and refrained from appealing to God for healing. So therefore, Hezekiah, as then the king of Israel, therefore hid the book so that the ill would be compelled to throw themselves upon God's mercy. Now, there are different opinions where this book come from. One opinion holds that God made these healing properties known to Moses in order to test the Jewish people. God wished to see whether they would recognize that all true healing is from God and appealed him, or would they would rather place their trust in the Book of Remedies. Now Hezekiah hid the book at that time because it began to lead the people astray, according to the Ramban, quoting on Leviticus 26:11, because the people would be involved in acts which we would call sinning and cause themselves injury and reach for this book and get healed. And since this act of hiding the book demonstrated Hezekiah's faith in God's healing, he invoked this act in his own plea for healing. Meaning, since that he could not access that book because he hid it away, he had to rely on his faith and trust for healing. And in fact, he was healed, and he would live another 15 years, and he would actually marry one of the daughters of Isaiah. Now, the Rambam, in his commentary of the Mishnah, in the Talmudic, in the section on the laws of the teachings of Pesach, Passover, dispute the above description of the Book of Remedies, that the Rambam was against the book, saying it was a book of magical healing written by a student of astrological lore. It was written only for study of magical phenomena, which is permissible, but later turned to practical use by unrighteous people. Since such healing is forbidden by the Torah, meaning to use magic for healing, Hezekiah was compelled to hide the book. Now, there are other opinions from the Radak and the Rashba. Remember, we talked about before, blessed souls, there can be disagreements in the oral Torah tradition to hopefully bring out the truth, that the Rashba and Radak hold that actually King Solomon put together, and there's even another opinion, a dissident opinion, that holds that these remedies were recorded by one of Noah's sons who were learned of them from an angel. Now, that should not be a foreign idea, blessed souls, that a human being can interact with an angel, because we do see in various points in the Torah itself, the five books of Moses, and in the Tak, the story of the prophets, where an angel is identified and speaking and giving some sort of instruction to human beings. So for me, it's not too hard to imagine that an angel would speak to one of the sons of Noah to teach him remedies. Now, when the Messiah comes, we do expect full healing for the entire human family experience, those who want to embrace these type of healings. At the same time, too, related to what will be the last section of our show, where the Most High laid down a ramification for Adam and Eve, or specifically Adam, from eating from the fruit of the tree of good and evil, that it was brought out that it would great difficulty now, he would Adam would have to eat of the herbs of the field. In earlier, it was also mentioned in the book of Genesis about the grasses of the field. And with that being said, blessed souls, there is this movement, which I'm glad is, and I'm kind of part of it, not as a formal educator, but as an activist to empower people to consider these type of options. We have, for instance, we have Dr. Gary Null, and I think I'm doing this as sort of like a public service announcement. I would heavily recommend anyone to see, because the way Dr. Null presents it, you could see it's devoid of any connections to witchcraft or sorcery. It's basically based on scientific endeavors, which I think the Rambam would ultimately embrace if he were alive today. I'm sure he would give kudos to Dr. Null. And Dr. Null made a video, which you can see on YouTube. It's called The Joy of Juicing. And I think the channel is PRNFM. And again, I hope to be mentioning in future shows teachings from The Joy of Juicing. And also, I just want to mention, just to plug it, hopefully this coming Tuesday morning from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m., I hope to have at my house naturopath Dr. Benjamin Sarlin, MD-MS, who wrote a book, Everything They Don't Teach at Harvard Medical School, A Diet for a Little Planet. And going back to that diet that they were given healthy food. It was for their, not just their physical health, but for their mental health. I'm going to just say one more thing. I'm going to segue to Dennis, because I'm sure he has what to say. That I heard a very interesting commercial this morning where they claimed to, again, it was a radio commercial. I didn't see any television commercial about it, where they actually went to a park where people were and asked them to carry 10 or 20 pound bags around the park to see how it would react. And their reactions were their knees started to hurt, their back started to hurt, they had other discomfort. And so the message of the commercial was that when a person is physically feeling down, it could be from the simple fact that they've overeaten and become obese. So there's nothing magical about that. There's nothing astrological about it, as there was a concern of Rambam with the Book of Remedies. And so King Hezekiah did a very, very, you could say maybe a courageous thing, maybe you could say he did a selfish thing, but his intent was is that people, when they get sick, and hopefully there'll be no more sickness from this day onward, we pray and hope, we can't guarantee it, because only God can do that, that we should realize there's ways of bringing that peace of mind that we need in our studies, whether it be spiritual matter, like we hopefully are serving on the table of your mind today, and also even secular matters, to have peace of mind through proper nutrition, proper exercise, and hopefully a healthy relationship lifestyle. Dennis, I'm sure you have what to say about these matters.
Well, Don, you covered a lot of human imperfections in the last couple of minutes.
Including myself.
Oh, well, I'm at the bottom of the list, so don't worry. So it doesn't make a difference. In life, there is no magic button. I'm sorry. There really isn't, not even in your horoscope. But we do know there's God, and he's a constant. We do know that he has given us a divine intellect and a body, or a zelum form that we use. We do know that the mind can control the body. How it does, we don't know. We don't know the depth of that control. We do know that in the planet here, there's wonderful things that God has put here, and they're growing. We don't know if any or all of them can help us, our body, our mind, otherwise. We don't know a lot of things. That's why we keep talking about knowledge is so important, because knowledge will do away with fear and get you back on the right track, because humans are imperfect. The imperfection is offset by knowledge. So the more knowledge you have, the less imperfect you should be. That doesn't mean you're going to be perfect. I'm sorry, it doesn't work that way. Again, there's no magic button. However, there may be something in our atmosphere, on our land, that is a cure for cancer. We don't know. We don't know if it's there. Did God put it there? We don't have the faintest idea. But we do have hope, and we do have belief and faith. Now, the other thing is, you mentioned the word magic. Well, our religion is sort of supernatural because God is not a human. So therefore, the relationship between God and humans, there's a sprinkling of spirituality there that is somewhat magical, but we don't know exactly what it is, but it's there. Now, take, for instance, someone trying to explain why somebody gets cancer, and all of a sudden they take no medicine, and inside a couple of months later, they go into remission.
Mm-hmm.
Scientists don't even know what caused it in the first place, nor what caused it to go into remission.
Mm-hmm.
Yet we have people that are cured from it, and then there's other people that get it back 5 or 6 years from now. So when you make a list of things, the biggest list in the world is what we don't know. All of the only advice I can give to you is go with what you know, trust and believe, and let your faith and belief direct you.
Amen. Thank you, Dennis. Now we're coming down to basically the last 10 minutes of the show. And we mentioned at the beginning of the show, we want to vibe out on two verses from Genesis, and we're going to read them now. From Genesis chapter 3, verses 18 through 19, quote, "And it will cause thorns and thistles to grow for you, and you shall eat the herbs of the field. With the sweat of your face or your brow you shall eat bread until you return to the ground, for you were taken therefrom, for dust you are, and dust you will return," which Dennis alluded to at the beginning of the show. We come from dust. We are dust. We go back to dust. But what I want to try to focus on right now for the next couple of minutes, blessed souls, with, of course, Dennis's cherished feedback, this whole idea of the fact that Adam, after that great action, which unfortunately was not for the the immediate positive, shall we say, accomplishment of Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, of eating from the fruit from the tree of good and evil, was that the ground now would be, so to speak, the Most High transferred his anger. And again, I don't want to, you know, I don't want people to think that, you know, associate God with anger, therefore there's imperfection, because just as his thoughts are not like our thoughts, his anger is not like our anger. And actually, even if we perceive an anger from above, if we look at that which took place in our own personal lives, we see at some level there is a dimension of mercy in it, even though at the moment where we sense that anger, it seems tough to take. So the anger, so to speak, the divine anger was transformed or transplanted or sublimated into the act of trying to grow produce on the earth, and therefore a new phenomena would take place in the growing of produce, even in those beginning moments of those first 7 days of creation onward, now going to say like the eighth day, when Adam had to face the repercussions of his action of eating of the fruit of the tree of knowledge and evil, that the earth now would bring forth thorns and thistles for you, and you will have to eat the grass or the herbs of the field. Now, eating of the grass of the field was not a punishment. It happened to be the fact that there is great nourishment. In fact, I even heard from Dr. Noll, which I wish I could only get this message to him, that he's promoting himself, like the juicing of wheat grasses and barley grasses. He mentioned last week in a show that if a grass grows up to 2 inches, that's a very potent form of human nutrition. But we see here, too, that the difficulty would be that the earth now would bring forth thorns and thistles, which could be impediments. Anyone who's walked in a field will note that if you see, when you see wildlife, the wild produce growing in the field, if you're not careful, a person can get cut on thorns or thistles or poison ivy or sumac or poison oak, that there would be the means by which now man would have to toil, as we see in verse 19, that the eating of bread, which of course was through the planting of grain, would have to be accomplished now with the sweat of your brow until Adam and Eve and all of us should return to the ground. And in this oral Torah tradition, the idea that the original occupation of human being is a farmer, an agricultural society, from the oral Torah tradition, we see that farming is actually an archetype, a means of us focusing in on what? Separating good from evil and cultivating, hopefully, good produce. The good produce of thought, the good produce of speech, the good produce of action. And every aspect of working soil and painstakingly producing food has its parallel in the work of self-refining ourselves, that we should be an elevated form of earth. Because, again, we come from the earth. So just as the earth has weeds and has things which are impediment, has little stones that you have to pluck out, so too we have little stony hearts. Sometimes we have little stones in our brain. Sometimes we have weeds growing in our brain, intellectually, spiritually, emotionally, mentally. And we have to find the means of self-cultivating, the plucking out, hopefully in the least painful way as possible, but facing up to those things which are rectification within ourselves. And the idea of the soil, because again, the fruit of the tree of good and evil was connected to soil, and so we are, and Israel humbly suggest and advise human soul to consider that the fall of grace from that particular action of Adam and Eve are repeatedly played out upon our own personal lives. The first thing that we should try to learn as part of the rectification of that original sin is to paradoxically mix together perseverance in self-refinement and also patience in self-refinement, that our experience living here upon this living earth should hopefully teach us that we many times we have to make repeated attempts if we wish to see results, and we must see with patience and wait with patience for efforts to give forth hopefully good fruit. Also, we should try to fertilize ourselves with spiritual input that promotes spiritual growth. So to speak, when I speak, hopefully it has a fertilization effect on others, and when Dennis speaks, hopefully it fertilizes myself with another perspective and those listening. And also we have to plow with ourselves to breaking up sometimes that complacency which congeals even harsher than the most harshest type of congealed substance that can, God forbid, heaven forbid, congeal up and cause spiritual artery blockage or vein blockage, that the heart, which is in our chest, should beat out and send out that message to the rest of our body. Because what's the message of the heart sending out the blood to all over our body? That the soul within our blood wants to get its job done. The soul will get its job done, but we shouldn't impede the mission of the blood, which has the soul within it, that's within every human being, to do its path. Last but not least, that we're all in this process, we have to remember one thing is ultimately going to happen. Because ultimately something started. We came from dust, and we are going back to dust. And hopefully that won't cause us to be depressed, blessed souls. That will actually inspire us. I once heard from Rabbi Dr. Avraham Tversky, said, okay, if we start from dust and we wind up in dust, well, we're still in this state of, you know, more tangible, living, moving, breathing, existentially existing dust, we might as well do some goodness world and rejoice in the fact we can live in joy in doing goodness world, making a better world, before we go back to ultimately where we came from, which is dust. Dennis, any thoughts on these matters?
Yes, the first thing that hit me is a correction, Don. But it's a subtle correction in the sense of Maimonides, who said, you cannot attribute to God human properties. And you said God gets angry. I would feel better if you said God was unhappy.
Well, there are prophetic. I'll react in that there are verses where it talks about the waxing fury of God, but again, it's not human anger. It's an attribute that he is the source of that we perceive. I mean, obviously he in unto himself does not have all these attributes, but as given to human perception, that it would appear to be, and the prophets identified and categorized it as say charon af, like a flaming, it's like an anger which is described as like a flaring up the nostrils. When a person gets angry, you know, they breathe deeply.
Don, I only brought that up for our listeners who listen.
Okay.
That Rambam had a teaching like that, and he brought it up in a lot of his writings, and he just thought that it should be reversed a little bit. That's why I said it's a subtle correction. It's not an error or a mistake, Don.
Right. But I just want to ask you, you and I wish I was living on a farm. I mean, I'm pretty sure you don't live on a farm, but
it would be a lot easier if we were living on farms, Don, but we're not.
Sure. But the idea of tilling one's own soil in one's human experience, what is your take on that? That, you know, we have to pluck the weeds from our consciousness, our emotional baggage, or our intellectual baggage, or our complacency. What's your take on these matters?
The word is, and we always remember it on Thanksgiving Day in this country, it's called bounty. The bounty of the earth is there for man. Mm-hmm. The bounty of the Lord is there for man.
True. So that's, with that being said, you know, we're basically at the end of the program. I do want to segue to one more song. Any concluding remarks that you'd like to make? And I'm not sure if we'll be rejoining next week. We have to see. You know, every week has its own nuances, especially as we're making preparation, hopefully, for our son's bar mitzvah. Any salient points you'd like to leave our blessed soul listeners with today's show? And I'd like to thank you as well for taking your most valuable time, your free time, to participate in today's program.
It's not my free time. It's God's time. And I like your explanation of the bounty from Genesis that you read today. You covered a wide expansion, so people should understand the motive, the objective, and why it's there. You explained it beautifully, Don. Thank you.
Thank you, so I'm humbled by your comments. And blessed souls, if we can leave with one seminal point to share with you today coming out of all of this discussion, I would wish a blessing for all of you listening in, who are listening in live or listening very soon in the archive version, to reduce the amount of worry in your life. Now, how does one reduce worry in one's life? Well, one should realize that as we are speaking, as we are listening, as we are breathing, We are being empowered by a creator who, in creator's ultimate wisdom, gave us something called a divine image, a Tzelem Elohim, something that Dennis talked about earlier in the show, the latter part of the show. And this Tzelem Elohim is no dream. It helps us get out and scrimmage in the field of life. And if we do it correctly, and we're bound to make some mistakes, we can do it with less war and turmoil and strife. So I want to end the show today, blessed souls, with a young man who I just discovered this past week. His name is Levi, or Levi Robin. He actually, from his picture, his promo picture seems to be a young Hasidic man. He's on tour with Matas Yahu, everyone's heard of already, who's made his mark in the music field. And kudos to Matas Yahu to give this young man, who I think, let me put it this way, if I were to describe to you Levi Robin before you listen to his music, I would say picture in your mind, if you were to combine together Simon and Garfunkel and Bob Dylan and go back to 1966 in your mind, for those of you old enough to remember 1966, that imagine if those three young men at that time in their lives had embraced Torah and integrated it into their lives and put it into their musical endeavors. And yet, Levi Robin is not copying Simon and Garfunkel, or is he copying Bob Dylan, or is he copying Pete Seeger, or is he copying Shlomo Carbach, or is he copying Bob Marley? He's coming forth, which I think is a unique sound, and I played this in front of a good friend of mine, some of his music, well, one of his songs, Simcha Edelstein, who himself is a decent musician, and he said that he has a unique sound, a unique voice, and unique guitar playing. And the name of the song, Bustos, we're going to end off with today is No Worries. And hopefully to accentuate the idea that we should have no more worries in our lives, or we wish upon no more worries upon any human being in the most ideological sense. We meditate that there should be no more worries. And also we want to wish everyone Ahav Echad, one love, Gor El Echad, one destiny, Kolano for all of us, Bardachi Shalom, in a peaceful, Bardachi Noam, in a pleasant way, Laham Shik, to be continued, Bezer Hashem Yisbrek, with the help of the Most High. Bless us, enjoy. This is Levi Robin, who right now is on tour with Matas Yahu. This is a song, No Worries. Take care, everyone. Thank you.